The following Dharma talk was given by Jodi Hojin Kimmel at the Zen Center of New York City. Hojin Sensei is the abbot of the Zen Center and head priest at Zen Mountain Monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org/zcnyc. Thanks for listening.
This talk will be on the second stage of training of the 10 ox herding pictures, which I'll start off painting for you. Good morning. Nice to see you all. I've been away for a while. I went to New Zealand. Just after the new year, we have a sangha there, believe it or not, all the way across the ocean. I'm very fortunate that I got to go there, and sometimes I wonder, why am I doing this? And we've been going there for 35 years because of one person who took to the Dharma and brought that back to New Zealand and started a sangha there. And Daito Roshi said, if you get 20 people together, I will come. And he did. And now we've continued to go. And we go actually now twice a year. Shugen Roshi goes in July, and I usually go January. And always when I land and I see the first person, and I feel their Dharma heart and can't wait to start practicing, I land right away. It's like, oh, this is why I'm here. This is why I'm here. We're practicing this life together. And this courage of all these folks over there who don't have a teacher or just that comes so infrequently, and how strong they maintain their practice. It's very inspiring. And so I remember that each time in that 20-hour flight, which is quite a place for Zazen, I must say. There's a certain pressure compressor there that really, like through the night, it's really something up floating up there. It's a little scary too, but anyway. So centuries ago, these famous ox herding pictures were created, and someone recognized that it was important to visually see, so they were painted as a teaching. And they were accompanied by short verses as well to help as pointers of what this stage of spiritual training is. So they depict stages of spiritual training, of development on a path of Buddha Dharma. And even though they're like 1 through 10, or there's other collections, we're not sequential, we're not linear. So it's more circular or spiral. So you may find yourself in stage one after 35 years, but you see that stepping on the path in a whole different way, with a whole new understanding. So you can step in at any time. If you go upstairs, you'll see the whole collection on the wall. And you might read one and say, ah, that's where I am, number 7 or something. And then you read number 2, it's like, no, I think I'm on number 2. And both are true. You'll find elements in the poems that you resonate with. And the ox came to represent our true nature, searching for our true nature, our Buddha nature. And I've been painting them for about a decade and trying to memorize the poems as teachings, as is suggested. And this Buddha nature is said to be that we're complete, we're perfect and complete, and we don't lack anything inherently, right from the beginning. All beings are perfect and complete, and as Suzuki Roshi says, and can use a little work, right from the beginning. And that's anyone we look at, any being is included in that. So just in case you wanted to leave someone out, we can't. It may not be recognized. It may not be realized. And that's what the path is about. So I started to work on the 10 stages of throwing a pot and making that our Buddha nature. I don't know how that's going to turn out. We'll see. It's fun, though. But anyway, it said when China was an agricultural society that, of course, the oxen and the buffalo were very much dependent upon to work the field. So these animals were held in high regard. They were really important and powerful and very much a part of the life there. They couldn't survive without their work. So this analogy of ox herding was very meaningful to Buddhists at that time. They could relate to this metaphor. It says, an early incidence of ox herding as a metaphor for finding a path of practice can be found in this story from the Tang Dynasty. This is 618. Once a monastic was working in the monastery kitchen when his master came in and asked what they were doing. And they replied, nothing much, just herding the ox. The master asked, how are you herding it? And the monastic replied, every time the ox wanders off to eat grass when they should be working, I rein them in and put them back to work. So as we can see in this second stage, there's somebody that's on the path and they're beginning to see some kind of traces of something. Not sure what, but a path has opened up and we're seeing footprints of something, a footprints of our nature, of our Buddha nature. We have a little opening to the possibility of experiencing our intrinsic self. And if that's what we're sort of on the path to kind of recognize, so like when you start out in stage one, that picture is just full of weeds. There's no path. We're just standing in the middle of the weeds. You know, we've done our life. We've gotten our degrees. We've gotten jobs. We've gotten relationships. And we still are having this feeling inside. Something's missing. Something just doesn't feel right. Something feels off. We don't know what. We don't even know how to address it, perhaps, but the feeling is so strong, and we may start looking around, and then for some of you, you ended up here this morning. That is that stage, like why you came. What was that responding to, that you showed up? And then you sat a bit, and it's like your knees hurt, your back hurts, your mind hurts. You get a little happy, it feels good. And there's all these fluctuations, and should I keep coming? Should I go right now? Should I go to lunch? Should I stay? And we're in this sort of back and forth. And then at the second stage, we're starting to trust a little more, and we're coming back to sit. So that's where we're picking up. We're continuing to practice, even though we're not sure exactly what is going on. So this is sometimes called discovering the tracks or finding the footprints. And I was walking down the steps and I told Stu this Buffalo Springfield song came to mind, which is that one that goes, ding, 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 something's happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. It's kind of, I feel like that is the second stage. Something's happening here, but what it is not exactly clear. And so we see a few traces, discovering the footprints, but most of what's happening is intellectual in a way. It's like we're thinking about it. Our body is getting adjusted to sitting. But we keep coming back to sit down to practice. So listen to the preface and the pointer, the verse. which is by Cú Chuan. He wrote most of them in that in like 960. He was a Linchi from the Linchi school, a Chan master, Kuan, from the 12th century, and he wrote these poems. The preface says, "With the aid of the sutras, we gain understanding through the study of the teaching. We find the traces. The many vessels are clearly all one gold, and we ourselves are the embodiment of the 10,000 things. But unable to recognize correct from incorrect, how are we to distinguish true from false? Since we have yet to pass through the gate, only tentatively have we seen the traces." The verse, "Along the river, deep within the forest, you find traces. Leaving behind the fragrant grasses, you study the subtle signs. The tracks, suddenly as clear as the distant sky, lead you into the endless mountains. There is no place to hide." There's a Waka poem along with this that says, "Deep in the mountains, the efforts bear fruit. Tracks, how grateful to see a sign." So we made a response to whatever was moving us. You came this morning, something was moving you, whether it was curiosity or somebody suggested it. You're here. We're here. It's a good thing. Amazingly, somehow we had enough to let go of the distractions of today. We concentrated on maybe a bit more what feels important to us to show up. Like this, no, it's early, I'm tired, I'm going to the Zendo. I'm still going. We brought ourselves here. And we notice a path opens up. You had beginning instruction. You sat down a period. Something's opening up. And finally, we come across some tracks. The ox has never been missing, but somehow we can't take hold of it. We don't know. Something's happening, but we don't know. It's not clear. We have a lot of ideas. That's what we hold on to. It's this. It's that. It's got to be this. No, it's not that. But we don't even know what we're comparing to or what we're holding to say that. With the aid of the sutras, we gain understanding. Through study of the teaching, we find traces. In the Flower Garland Sutra, it's written, "The grasses and trees of the land and earth are all Buddhas." In the Nirvana Sutra, it says, "All sentient beings, whatever, have the Buddha nature." And the Diamond Sutra expounds, "Rouse the mind that resides nowhere." So we start to grow in comprehension of words. They light up our mind, right? It's like, yes. Like we read Buddha Dharma or something, and it's like, yes, that makes sense. I feel that. And we also feel it could be just more in the head. It's not really what our body's getting as well. We see some tracks. We have not found the ox. But we're encouraged to carry on. What are these traces? What are these tracks? That we're almost wherever we look. I was thinking of a poor joke. I don't know, it just came up, but you may know this story. I'll tell it anyway. I had to think if I wanted to, but a person was in their house and there was a flood. You may know the story. And it was up to the first floor, and a boat came. And this person was a real righteous person. They really believed in God. They prayed a lot. And they really thought God was going to save them. So a boat came, and they said, come on, get in. And he said, I'm waiting for, God will save me. And then the water's rising, going higher. Another boat comes and says, come on, it's time, get in the boat. And it's like, no, God will save me. And then he's up on the top of the roof. They send a helicopter. And he's like, God will save me. And of course, everything just got washed away. And so he went to heaven. And because he was so righteous and really believed in God, he had a conversation. He says, where were you? Why didn't you save me? And he said, I sent a boat. I sent another boat and a helicopter. So the point being, it's sometimes we have ideas about something's going to save us. And those things are around us all the time. They're always being sent. It's the tracks are and traces are right in front of us all the time. So we sit down so we can begin to experience that that's so with our body too. And we see that the mind is really undisciplined, has a very erratic, wandering nature. As you see, the ox herder still has a rope in their hands to rope it in. And we begin to calm down, and we get the sense of something. Something's happening here. A little light goes on at this stage from these Dharma study, from what we're hearing in chanting the sutras. And we experience this glimmer of rightness. Just something feels right, even though there's discomfort and we everything that we come in with, it can hold it, and yet it's uncomfortable and we're turning around. But yet there's something that feels so right. And maybe you know this. Even in the short time that you've sat today, you could feel some way that you've turned is right. A lot of people say, I feel like I've come home. As soon as they sit down, I feel like I've come home. What kind of homecoming is this? What are we coming home to when we sit down? What is that? That experience. I feel like I've come home to something. What? What do we call home? When do you feel at home? What are the qualities of home? And how about when we leave home, when we've left home, what does that feel like? Is that why we say, I feel like I've come home? Because have we been home? Not exactly sure, but we keep following this rightness. And the path opens up and we discover more Dharma tools of exploration. And then we test the guidance, more importantly. We're hearing these sutras and sit still and count your breath, and we've got to put it together. And we all have a different path. We all have to put this together because we're different. We're so different in that way. So we have these pieces, and then we're like here, and we have to put that all together to make sense for ourselves. When we're not sure what makes sense, or that we have to make sense, we just feel the rightness. And so trust and confidence a little bit start to develop, even in the midst of this wandering, erratic nature that's present. And so we continue to take the backward step. Yeah, so we have this unmistakable direct experience that's happening, and it's not just a blind faith. And that's so important, is that it's, you know, that was one of the things I was so happy about in beginning instruction, which I received from Shugen Roshi, where he said, no one's going to give you anything. And I was relieved, and I was also like upset. Like, I really wanted someone to give me something. But he said it's based on our own direct experience, working with our pain, our sweat, our tears, our joys, our afflictive thoughts, learning what thoughts are. What is a thought? Are we our thoughts? These are things that start coming as you turn around. Like, what is this thing that keeps arising? This in my head, this narrative, this story, these words, what are they? Are they permanent? Is that who I am? Am I my thoughts? So this investigation starts to arise in us. And little lights start to go on. And then we see, as we step off our cushion, that this is actually starting to infuse our life a little bit more. Like, we didn't blow up at someone when we usually do. It's changing our relationships. We go into the office and we just, something feels different. How we're seeing people, how we're seeing ourselves. And so that's the important part, is this has to come off the cushion. We're not going to sit all day. I wish we could. That would solve a lot. But we're not. So Kinhin, the walking meditation, is the beginning of showing how this moves into life. Can we just walk? We see it's not so easy. Dot, 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 just walking. Did I walk? Did I eat? We don't know. We lose the contact. Something's missing. We feel that pain of that loss of connection. We want to get back home. It's been happening for a long time. And suddenly, we start to make the connections. We start to feel more. So it could feel like, oh, this practice is bringing up a lot. Like, I don't know that that's the point. It's like all the things start, we start to see what's happening with us. And we learn how to focus. We learn how to focus, concentrate. Maybe it's not quite the whole body-mind expression, but now we're attracted to practice, and practice impels us to search further, to keep going. I remember when I first sat down and then took that home and continued to sit, I think I was too close to the wall. When I learned beginning instruction in college, it was a really small room, like really small. And so we had to sit right up against the wall, and I thought that's what I had to keep doing. So I never put any space between me and the wall until I realized I can move. I tested it. Can I move back a little? And I was like, oh yeah, of course I can. But there was something about facing the wall that was just a wall, the wall of my mind. And I started to count, and eventually I was like, a thought would come up and I was like, I don't have to think that. I don't have to continue to do that. I can't stop what happened, like a thought arose, but I realized I can stop. I cannot cling to it and grasp it and keep it going if I chose to. I wanted to experiment with that. And so I would alternate sometimes between excitement and doubt, conviction, boredom. very inspired and motivated, and then forgetting what I was doing and just sitting there, sort of sitting there. I would feel despair. I would never find my nature. I could feel skepticism sneaking in about teachings, teachers, Buddha, all these things that were being brought in. And my ability in this, finding traces. So, again, meeting the ideas of what this should look like, and then surrendering many times to just trust the sitting and this great temple, this great school of mystery that we're entering by turning back, this great school of mystery. And I remember asking Daito Roshi, I said, I keep hearing you say, and other teachers, everyone has the Buddha nature. Aren't there a few of us that kind of don't fit that category, possibly? Like, I was, might have been in my one of despair mode. And he looked at me and he said, he had these, like, you know those fish with the eyes that come out? That was kind of Daito, like a goldfish. Big watery eyes that was very penetrating. And he looked at me and he said, everyone means everyone without exception. And then he started to bring up all the cruel people he could think of that had the Buddha nature, all the loving people that he could think of that had the Buddha nature, all beings. He said, some may realize it and some may not. Some may see, some may not. He would say, this will take time, so be patient. I always felt very impetuous, like, you know, now, I want it now. You know, McDonald's mentality, get that food, get out and eat it, you know. And he was saying, you have to go slow. This is an endless practice, so just keep practicing. Ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding. So, at this stage, too, we might get intoxicated a bit by some of the wrappings, which is fine. It's hey, who doesn't want out of where they are sometimes? So, to see hear bells and see robes, unique gestures, new art forms. There's a kind of aura that makes it feel special and sacred, and in a way it is, but it isn't. There's novelty, of course, and there's a lot of intensity, for sure, when we connect with it. But they are just skillful means and part of the tradition, and they're important, and they speak. They have a language, and yet we can just be intoxicated with the atmosphere. But that takes a while, too, to see how these things are coming together. And Daito Roshi would call this the honeymoon period. You know, when everything's really great at the beginning, we're on our honeymoon, the honeymoon period. And, of course, that as we keep deepening, you know, more things come up. Just like any partnership. There's that first honeymoon period, and then we see all the bumps and warts and gases and all that. So he said, keep practicing. And I know for myself, the second retreat I did was the wilderness retreat, because I think nature is always the great leveler. We can't sort of have bells and robes and whistles in nature. And Daito took us on this trip, and, you know, I really wanted to see how he dealt with the elements of nature, how he treated the earth and the people on the trip. A couple monastics went, No robes, no little incense. Little Buddha out there. People were making them with acorns and stones. Just to kind of see a different context, right? And get a reality check for myself. Well, I'm still here. You passed that test. And so we keep focusing on our breath, and that develops what we call jhariki. We develop this power of concentration, the capacity to focus our attention on one thing, our breath, one activity, wholeheartedly. And we could see the mind begins to calm down, the body begins to calm down. Mostly we start with the calming the body down, because the mind will follow more easily if we have a calmer body. Body has its own experience too. But usually it's fine. It doesn't have language. Like the body doesn't say the things that our head says, right? It just sits. It doesn't talk. So when we can settle the body, the mind begins to calm, distractions start fading away. Our trust in ourselves deepens. Entertainment is not so interesting. And this all encourages us to keep practicing. And the real work is starting to begin. The road to the true self, as one teacher said, is not for the weak. There has to be some longing, being able to leap into the unknown and giving up some control. Oh yeah. I would say this stage is equivalent to surrender, to surrendering. What is surrender for you? How do we surrender to the teachings of Zazen, to the breath, to the koan, to surrender to letting go of attachments, trust that, dualistic thinking, to really enter, I don't know. That's surrender for sure. So we keep surrendering to the truth we find in the body, in our mind, in concert, beginning to get into concert with each other. And this word truth is a big word. It's not something that I can define. It's unmistakable. And we each have to find what that is. No one can give us the truth. We can point, it's said in teachings, but we have to actually make that for us the truth, our truth. That's where it has power. And we begin to touch what we call, is known as the three pillars of Zen that Kaplo Roshi spoke of. Great doubt. What is this? What's happening? Who am I? What is birth? What is death? That doubt, not the little doubt like, am I okay, you know, with my hair this long or, you know, something of that nature, but great faith and great determination. Perhaps we're beginning to discover that, and that's being cultivated, these pillars. And it's not unusual that we go back again and venture back to what's familiar and safe, to afflictive emotions where we thought we were finished with that, but it's back again, or something that we thought was over and it's back again. That's not unusual because that's familiar. There's a safety to it in this odd way, yeah? But we can study that. And through trust and fierce determination, we start to see a conversion taking place between intellectual understanding and how it moves into the body. and becomes a personal, intimate experience. Spontaneity starts to come. We surprise ourselves. We don't know who we are. Something spontaneous happens, and we're like, oh my God. Because it bypassed where we had to like go in our head all the time. It was just, we felt it, and we trusted it, and it happened. More and more. More and more things come to us as space opens that is available that we were blocking, like, you know, we think of someone and there's a call from them. And just these more open channels start to come as we make more room and not so much in our head. We might still call it my practice for a while, but that's okay. It can seem special for a while, rarefied, separate from washing our face, walking the dog, picking it up, their mess. It's all the same. It's all our spiritual life, our life, our practice, all of that. That is sacred activity. But for a while we make it distinct that we have to be in a space and doing this and wearing this or having this, but then it all starts to see it. Could this be my entire life? Is this sacred? And the internal dialogue lessens and lessens. We may have short periods, very short, where there's a gap, where we just forgot ourselves. We forgot. Forgetting the self, that is critical in seeing our true nature. This self that we create, seeing the ox. Because if we get caught in or hold this idea of who we are, our status, our position, that will take up the space. Or if we think what the ox might look like. Dida used to say, when the thoughts disappear, the thinker disappears. They are interdependent entities. He said, this is called samadhi, the single-pointedness that Buddha experienced when he saw the morning star and was set free, the light that penetrated the darkness of ignorance. He experienced the emptiness of all the conditions, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, as we chanted in the Heart Sutra. Everything in this stage comes under scrutiny. We may experience we're an ox of plain raw fear. We may experience we're an ox of frustration. We may be an ox of pure joy. This is what we want to push away something, it returns. We want to chase it, it recedes. Traces abound, but if there is a gap, it will be distant. If it's something outside of us. We all have this something nature we call an ox, but we can't have a picture of it at all. So forget the picture. We are constantly revealing ourselves as the ox, but we don't realize it. We think it's something is missing. It's somewhere else. Next part of the verse says, the many vessels are clearly of one gold, and they themselves are the embodiment of the 10,000 things. The 10,000 things are clearly yourself. We go to the kitchen store and there's a lot of pots and pans and utensils. Maybe they're all made of metal, all shapes and sizes, all made of the same element, the same material. There are innumerable beings of all different kinds and variety. And all these, in their infinite variety, there's no gap between their true nature. we bodily realize the 10,000 things just as they are as ourself. It is written, I am the same root as all heaven and earth. I am one body with the 10,000 things. But unable to recognize correct from incorrect, how are we to distinguish true from false? Since we have yet to pass through the gate, only tentatively have we seen the traces. The Heart Sutra says, all dharmas are forms of emptiness, without birth or death, are not tainted, not pure, do not increase nor decrease. It talks about no eye, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no color, no sound, no smell, no taste, no touch, no object of mind, no world of eyes, through to no world of mind consciousness. If we forget these senses as we use them, forgetting our eyes, forgetting our nose, forgetting our ears, our tongue, our body, our mind, as we perceive things, those things themselves, our mind doesn't increase or decrease one bit. It's not stained or pure. It reflects things exactly as they come to us. Amazing. There's no gap. Master Rinzai has said, we see a fire, but our mind doesn't burn. The mind, just as it is that clarity of the true nature. The true Dharma has no fixed form, and yet it extends throughout the 10 directions. The whole universe is the ox of our own clear mind. The whole universe is the ox of our own clear mind. The Buddha, when he was awakened at the sight of the morning star, said, how wondrous, all beings are endowed with the very same clear mind to which I have just awakened. Everything is shining all at once. That's what happens. His mind became free of any traces of anything at all. He could become the river, the mountain, the flowers. He could be all things. He was all things. And this wondrous wisdom which he has awakened, which all beings are endowed with, does not come to us from practice. In a way it does. We're already with that wisdom. Practice just opens that up. It's revealed what's always been right here. We follow the tracks until we catch it, and we don't give up. We focus. Don't be discouraged. The Waka poem says, determination deep. In the mountains, your efforts bear fruit. Tracks. How gratifying to see a sign. So let's do our very best to not disorient each other, to not make chaos and confusion. There's plenty of it. So let's really try to not disorient ourselves so we don't disorient others, create chaos, confusion, learn to focus, be still, network our intelligence and help each other. Practice not being scattered. I was reading something by Naomi Klein. Do you know Naomi Klein? She's an activist, author, so a filmmaker, and known for her political analysis. And she has this thing she calls, I think it's actually a book called Shock Doctrine, where she says, using chaos and crisis to push through radical changes while people are too disoriented to effectively resist she cites as a known strategic exploitation of cognitive limits. And then that was followed by some wise words of a sociologist, Jennifer Walter, who says, your overwhelm is the goal. So let's be aware of that, our overwhelm. And she says, deeply care about and focus your attention. You can't track everything. That's by design. Impact comes from sustained focus, not scattered awareness. So our focus is an act of resistance to not scatter, become overwhelmed, and don't rush, okay? So don't rush. There's this push to rush, so we can't really take things at the pace of our heart to have genuine understanding. So we're learning an active patience so we don't rush to regain the power that we can use for awakening. So powerful it is. And then give that away. Give that away to those who need it. Be kind and clear, a focused, breath-breathing human being as best we can. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about the Zen Center of New York City's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit our website at zmm.org/zcnyc.